All right, we are going to be in 1 Kings 13 today. 1 Kings 13, excuse me, 2 Kings 13. 13 is where we will begin. Verse number 1, in the 23rd year of Joash, the son of Ahaziah, king of Judah. All right, so if you're looking at it on the list here, that would be the Joash, the bottom of the column on the left. That's Joash of Judah. Began, three and 20th year of Joash, the son of Ahaziah, king of Judah, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, began to reign over Israel and Samaria and reigned 17 years. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord and followed the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. He departed not therefrom. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he delivered them into the hand of Hazael, king of Syria, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, all their days. Okay, so that brings us to Jehoahaz. This is the king of Israel. His lineage is that he was the son of Jehu. Okay, his father was the king, and before Jehu was a king, Jehu had been a general in the army under Ahab. Okay, or Ahab's son. So, you know, his upbringing was, you know, his dad had both a military background and a royal background. Now, when Jehu became king, what did he do with the worshipers of Baal? Does anybody remember? Doc gave us this, and that's right. Jehu exterminated Baal worship, but Jehu continued to follow the calf worship that goes all the way back to Jeroboam. Okay, so his father had done, you know, one good thing, but he continued to follow in the line of Jeroboam as far as the worship. So his reign began, as we're told here, in the 23rd year of Joash. His father Jehu had eliminated Baal worship but followed the calves. Well, Jehoahaz followed in the line of his father and continued to worship the golden calves of Jeroboam. So it's interesting, isn't it, how one decision continued to affect so many future generations? I mean, in America, we could go back to, and I mean, obviously things get changed, modified, reinterpreted, whatever. But I mean, if you go back to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, you know, the amendments and all of those kinds of things. I mean, how much different would America have been already if there were not the first 10 amendments to the Constitution? I mean, obviously, tyranny's in the heart of man if they can get power, but, you know, some of those things have been slowed down by some of those decisions, right? That's a, you know, somewhat simple example. But this on the religious side, the calf worship of Jeroboam was a continual stumbling block the entire time Israel, the northern kingdom, existed as a nation until they went into captivity. Now, it says here, he began to reign in the 23rd year of Joash, and he reigned 17 years. Well, Joash, you know, reigned 41 years, I believe, 40 or 41, so if you add, you know, 23 and 17 together, you get 40. So I think, okay, he and Joash must have ended up about the same time, but that's not exactly how it happened. If you look down in verse number 10, in the 37th year of Joash, king of Judah, began Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, to reign over Israel. I'm like, okay, you know, how do we get there? There's, you know, multiple explanations which are, you know, wordy and confusing. There's a couple of possibilities there, but as I have told you previously, the discernment of dates in Old Testament times is not as straightforward as we would like it to be. One commentator has posited that maybe Jehoahaz had his son to begin to reign, you know, towards the end of his time, and that overlapped a few years. There were other kings that overlapped. One of those was Uzziah, you know, when he was struck with leprosy. You know, then his son ruled because he was separated from the palace. But, you know, another very real possibility is that the dates were not calculated the way we would do it. I left off with a brief explanation of that last time, I believe, but Usher, who was a Jewish man who developed a system of dating that's been, you know, largely referred to and largely followed by a lot of Bible students, said particularly with the kings of Israel, they counted things differently than we do. Okay? So, if a kid has a birthday and they're all excited, all right, I'm five. All right? What that means is it's been 5 full years have passed since the day of their birth. You know, you ask a kid how old they are, I'm 3 and a half. You know, I'm 3 and 10 months. You know, they're counting it down. But the way we do it is we don't count it as 4 years or 5 years or 29 and holding until we complete that year. So if someone's 29 years old, then they've lived a full 29 years. Usher says that particularly with the kings of Judah, if a king had served 4 years and then served one day at the start of his fifth year, that would be counted as 5 years that he was king. So as soon as they start the next increment, that would be added onto their total. Okay, that's not the way we do it. But in some of the calculations, it was done that way. That in and of itself would help to explain some of the difficulties of why don't these numbers add up. Okay, because they didn't calculate their dates exactly the same way we do all the time. And sometimes, you know, it just doesn't line up like we would like it to. But the Usher said that the years were calculated from Nisan to Nisan. If I'm remembering correctly, Nisan was the first month of the year when they had the Passover and all of that. And then if he, you know, 2-3 days in, 1 month in, that would be counted as another year on his service record, so to speak. So, anyway, if you notice there in verse 3, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he delivered them into the hand of Hazael, king of Syria. Why? Because he continued the worship of the golden calves. Okay, so we see here that he was delivered by God into the hand of Syria as judgment for his idolatry. Verse number 4, Jehoahaz besought the Lord, and the Lord hearkened unto him. I don't know, maybe you just read over that and you're like, yeah, that's what they should have done. They should have prayed to God, and you know, God hears and answers prayers. But have you stopped to consider the fact that we're talking about a man who, as king, chose to follow idolatry? I mean, he's made his choice. He's following the sins of Jeroboam, and apparently God's given him time, and he has set his direction. So this really is a significant statement here that he prayed to the Lord. That was not his normal course of worship. His normal course of worship was to go to the house of the idols and sacrifice to the calves and so forth. But he turned to the Lord. You see the name there's all caps. You know that's the name of the true God of Israel. And here's the next phrase. It's also very interesting. And the Lord hearkened unto him. Now, I mean, that's a difficult balance for us as flawed human beings, is it not? When do you show mercy and try to help someone and continue to reach out and help? And when do you say, okay, enough's enough, and you know, I've done everything I can do, now you just have to reap the consequences of your choices? It's interesting. I ask those questions. The looks on faces are different. Some of you lean more towards the side of give them another chance and, you know, work with them and be merciful. And some of you have more of a set jawline. No, that's it. You're done. You've had your chances. But, you know, by all rights, God did not have to answer his prayer here, did he? He was a idolater. He had not served the Lord. And yet, when he besought the Lord hearkened unto him. Verse number 4, it says, he saw the oppression of Israel because the king of Syria oppressed them. Why was Syria oppressing them? Because God allowed it. Because they had disobeyed. So, verse number 5, the Lord gave Israel a savior. So they went out from under the hand of the Syrians, and the children of Israel dwelt in their tents as before time. So that term savior there does not mean, it's not a reference to Christ as the Messiah. That is just simply a term for a deliverer. He sent them a deliverer. So he God delivered them from the oppression of Syria. And it's interesting, the next verse tells us that there is a expected response. Okay, he turned to God and God delivered him. Now, as far as we know, would we call Jehoahaz a saved man? We would not call him a saved man. We would not call him a worshiper of God or whatever Old Testament term we would use. And yet, did God choose to answer a prayer for him? Yeah, he did. Okay. You ever heard of foxhole prayers or, you know, rock bottom prayers where somebody says, God, if you'll get me out of this? There are times when God does choose, he's not obligated to, but he does at times. Here, an idolater turns to God and God says, all right, fine, I'm going to help you. I'm going to answer your prayer. But look in verse number 6. Nevertheless, they departed not from the sins of the house of Jeroboam, who made Israel sin, but walked therein, and remained that there remained the grove also in Samaria. So what does that tell us here? That tells us that when God does deliver, there is an expected response. He remained a worshiper of the calves. It's mentioned there in verse number 6. But when God does answer a prayer like that, there is an expected response. God says, all right, I'm going to show him mercy. I'm going to reveal myself to him. I'm going to deliver him. I'm going to prove that I am the true God and not the idols that he's worshiping. But then there was an expected response. In turn, he was expected to, you know, worship the Lord, turn away from the idols. But verse 6 tells us that he continued in his chosen path, worshiping the calves. That's what's the reference there with the sins of the house of Jeroboam. The last phrase, that the grove remained also in Samaria. You see that very often, a grove associated with idolatrous worship. Some commentators will tell you that that is, when we think of a grove, we think of a stand of trees, you know, a grouping of trees. Some other historians and commentators will tell you that sometimes the grove referred to what we would call carvings that were associated with the idolatrous worship and stuff, and they were planted in the ground like posts, and, you know, there were outdoors and maybe trees around that as well. But the groves were always associated with idolatrous worship. Verse 7, neither did he leave of the people. All right, now, so you see verse 5 and 6 is a parenthetical statement. Verse 5 says, he prayed to the Lord because King Syria oppressed them. And then verse 7 is going to pick back up with the judgment. 5 and 6 is a parenthetical statement. God decided he was going to deliver them. God sent them a Savior, and he did not change his course of action towards the Lord. So verse 7 goes back to the story now with the king of Syria. Neither did he leave of the people to Jehoahaz but 50 horsemen, 10 chariots, and 10,000 footmen. For the king of Syria had destroyed them and made them like the dust by threshing. Now that's a really sad statement that's given in a compact form, right? A very much a summary statement. He says he destroyed them and made them like the dust by threshing. Have you ever done a project that, you know, created a lot of dust? Not talking about dusting the house, but even if you sometimes if you're just doing a wood project, use the saw, make sawdust. Or, you know, there are other, you know, certain projects that just seem to stir up dust. But the dust by threshing refers to the process of harvesting the wheat and, you know, processing the grain. They would beat it to loosen the kernels from the husks, and then they would toss it up in the air and let the wind carry away the light husks, and the heavier kernels would fall back down into their screens that they had and stuff. But that process of either beating it out with sticks, or sometimes they would take the animals and have them walk on top of it to crush it and begin that process. I mean, that was a very dusty process. If they'd harvested the wheat, the barley, whatever, you know, the threshing floor would have been a very dusty place. And that's what's left. They were just smashed to very small pieces. He started with a lot larger army, and he was left with 10,000 footmen. Now, that may sound like a lot to you and me, but when we have read already about the different armies, is 10,000 on the high side, or is that on the low side from the troops that would normally come with an invading army? It's very much on the low side. I mean, a lot of times it was 100,000, okay, that would come, or you know, much larger number. So leaving him 10,000 footmen, it was enough for him to have a little bit of security force, but it absolutely was not enough for him to bother anybody else. It was barely enough to go on defense, much less to play offense, if we could say it that way. So this is the end result. He was under oppression by Syria. God delivered him. He didn't change his course, so God allowed this to continue, and this is the end result. Verse number 8, the rest of the acts of Jehoahaz and all that he did and his might, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? And Jehoahaz slept with his fathers, and they buried him in Samaria, and Joash his son reigned in his stead. Well, the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel apparently is a different history book from the book that we have, and that we call 1st and 2nd Chronicles in our Bible. There's not much mentioned about Jehoahaz at all in 1st and 2nd Chronicles. 1st and 2nd Samuel detail basically the life of David. It's the ministry. 1 Samuel's the ministry of the prophet Samuel, his ministry, and then his anointing of Saul when the people said, "We want a king." But very early on, David was identified. And a lot of the events of Saul are overlaid with the life of David. 2 Samuel's all about the life and reign of David, the promises God made to David. 1 and 2 Kings is everybody else up to the captivity. 1 and 2 Kings deals with both the north and the south. Chronicles, 1 and 2 Chronicles is focused exclusively on the house of David and the kings of the south. The only mentions of the kings of Israel in Chronicles are as it pertains to their interactions with the king of the south, typically. All right? This would be, Jehoahaz is not an example of that, but his son, Jehoash, would be an example of that. Because you know Jehoahaz, the main thing that we know about him was he worshipped the idols. God sent judgment in the form of the kings of Syria. Okay, his son was also dealing with the king of Syria. In fact, when we deal with his son, we're going to get to a familiar story to many of you, where his son interacted with the prophet Elisha. Okay, but that's the main thing that we know. Nothing about that is mentioned in Chronicles. However, when his son fought against the southern kingdom of Judah, that is mentioned in 2 Chronicles. So, from the life of Jehoahaz, what are the lessons that we can learn that we can apply for ourselves? Well, number one, individuals must make their own choices to follow or to reject God. I mean, he was not required to worship the calves of Jeroboam like his father had done. He had the freedom to worship God. In fact, he at one point did ask the true God for deliverance. But then he made his own choice to continue with the calf worship after that was over. But I think this is another lesson. I've pointed it out already. But sometimes God shows mercy to the lost or those with, this is my term, insincere prayers. Maybe he was feeling it at the moment and he changed his mind. Maybe it was insincere. I don't know. But God sometimes shows mercy to those that, if I could say it this way, would we have considered him a good person, a godly person? No. But God chose to answer his prayer. So does that mean you can be ungodly and God will answer your prayers? No. That's not the take home. What is the take home? God sometimes does things for his own reasons. I mean, what is one of the primary things that I can come up with is that he was an idolater. He turned to God and God said, okay, I'm going to show myself to be the true God. When God does that, it's so that men will worship him as they should. Not because he was endorsing his idolatry or, you know, anything like that. You can look at this and read into it other things if you want to. The reality is God was revealing himself. Let me ask you this may be a duh question, but maybe it'll make you think a little bit. Did God reveal himself to you before or after you got saved? I mean, that should be an obvious answer, right? But if we're not careful, we tend to think, okay, God only deals with good people, godly people, you know, people are trying to do right, whatever. That's not the case. Obviously, he saves sinners, but even in other instances, sometimes God works on behalf of people to draw them to himself, to reveal himself to them. Okay? That's what happened here with Jehoahaz, but we also see there that there's an expected response to God's mercy. God showed him deliverance. He gave them a savior and got him out from under the oppression of Syria for a while. And there was an expected response there, which was that he should have turned to God and stopped the idolatry. He should have ceased the worship of Jeroboam's calves. Okay, he did not do that. And as a result, you know, God lifted his hand of blessing and the judgment continued. And that's pretty much all we know. All we're told of significance about Jehoahaz is he was an idolater. God gave him a reprieve, and he continued to be an idolater. Well, you know, who knows what else could have been accomplished there if he had turned to the Lord, but he did not. Okay, so that's Jehoahaz, who was king of Israel. And then the next king of Israel here is Jehoash. This is always fun. You know, we've got Jehu and Jehoram, Jehoahaz, Joash, Jehoash, you know, all these names that start with J. It's really makes it even more of a challenge to keep the name straight sometimes. But we're told here in verse number 9 of chapter 13, Joash his son reigned in his stead. Verse 10, in the 37th year of Joash king of Judah began Jehoash son of Jehoahaz to reign over Israel and Samaria, and he reigned 16 years. Okay, so three J names in one verse. But this is correlating it here. So Joash is the primary way that we know the king of the south. Jehoash is the primary way that the king of the north is referred to. But both names are used. You see it here in verse 9, he's referred to as Joash, and in verse 10, he's referred to as Jehoash, and it's the same guy. Okay, so the names are used interchangeably there. All right, so obviously, as a lineage, he's the son of Jehoahaz, which makes him the grandson of Jehu. He also grew up in the home of a king. His father was a worshiper of Jeroboam's calves. And what was his father's legacy? His father's legacy was the conquering by Syria and the resultant humility. His army was reduced to a very small force. He had just 10 chariots and 50 horsemen. In other words, he was humiliated. He was reduced to a subservient status. He was not a powerful ruler. That was the end result with Jehoahaz. Okay, so now Jehoash in the south has to make his own choices. Verse number 11. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. He departed not from the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin, but he walked therein. Verse 12. And the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did and his might wherewith he fought, are they not written in the books of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? We're not told very much there, are we? Oh, idolatrous. He was judged too. It's kind of interesting. You want your life to count for something in God's book? Then invest it in things that please the Lord. He was an idolater, and we don't get really any detail about his time other than he was still under oppression from Syria. Now, what we do know, beginning in verse number 14, is that he ruled near the end of Elisha's life. Verse 14 says, Elisha was fallen sick of his sickness wherever he died, and Joash, the king of Israel, came down unto him and wept over his face. Now, this Joash, king of Israel, is Jehoash that we're talking about here. Okay, remember, these names are used interchangeably. So we have Joash, Israel, and Joash, Judah. That's the way I've delineated them in my notes so I can keep it straight myself. But here in verse number 14, this is Joash Israel. Joash, king of Israel, came down unto him and wept over his face and said, Oh, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. Does that phrase sound familiar? the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof? Anybody remember where that phrase was used before in the Old Testament? Yep, when Elijah was caught up by whirlwind into heaven. That's what Elisha said of his mentor, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. Okay, that was a sign of respect. Chariots were a form of defense, and it was a sign of power. And so, you know, this was an acknowledgement of his influence and his might and so forth. This was a term of respect. The chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. Verse 15, Elisha said unto him, take bow and arrows. And he took unto him bow and arrows. And he said to the king of Israel, put thine hand upon the bow. And he put his hand upon it. And Elisha put his hands on the king's hands. Now, this is kind of interesting. Verse 14 tells us that Elisha was sick and that this was going to be a terminal illness. We're not told this part of the story, so I don't know if Elisha kind of summons the strength to sit up or stand up, or if he's like, take your bow and arrow, all right, come over here, and while he's propped up in his bed, he does the next thing. But it says there that in the verse 16, Elisha put his hands on the king's hands. Now, if he's elderly, which I think he was at this point, at least especially for the lifespans of Bible times, you know, at this point in time, for somebody to live 60 years was, you know, a notable thing in many cases. I think Elisha was well past that. But, you know, he was, I don't think he was necessarily helping him draw the bow. This simply was a sign of blessing, okay, when he puts his hand on it. But he put his hand on the king's hands, verse 17, and he said, open the window eastward. And he opened it. And then said Elisha, shoot. And he shot. And he said, the arrow of the Lord's deliverance and the arrow of deliverance from Syria. For thou shalt smite the Syrians in Aphek till thou hast consumed them. So we see here in this section from verses 14 through 25, Elisha prophesies deliverance from Syria. So I think it's interesting that, you know, Elisha put his hands on the king's hands. You know, in an indirect way, it was an acknowledgement that, you know, Elisha as God's spokesman, his prophet, this message came from Elisha, which came from the Lord. Okay, this was kind of an endorsement, if you will. But the first thing he says is just shoot. So he shot. It could just simply be that in Elisha's window, the window faced east. Okay, maybe he chose the east for a particular reason. Some commentators have speculated that you know, the Syrians were coming from the east, like they had conquered the area on the other side of the Jordan River. And they were coming, you know, from east to west as they were attacking Israel. And so this would have been fired in the general direction of the enemy's camps, although obviously this is nowhere near hitting any of them. But nonetheless, it was symbolic in the direction of the attacks that they were receiving. He says in verse 17, the arrow of the Lord's deliverance. So Elisha states, this arrow is a symbol that God is going to fight for you. Why an arrow? Because it's going to be a military conflict. This is not a drought where God's going to send rain or, you know, some other type of plague where God's going to send healing. This is warring with the king of Syria. So the arrow was symbolic of the military conflict. Verse 18, he said, take the arrows, and he took them, and he said unto the king of Israel, smite upon the ground. And he smote thrice and stayed. Now, there have been times when I've read this and thought, okay, he's just like, boop, 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 you know, probably was not shooting into the floor of Elisha's room there. Probably is shooting out the window. The first one was just more of a long-range shot, see how far it goes, but basically just shoot into the ground. Maybe it was a dirt floor and he's shooting in the ground, probably shooting out the window towards the ground. Is there any significance there? Possibly. I mean, it's possible that the first one symbolized the launch of a battle, you know, like the cry to charge and engage the enemy. and the other one might, you know, symbolize an enemy that's below you that you're shooting into. It's possible. But he said, smite the ground. So it says he smote thrice and stayed. Verse 19, the man of God was wroth with him and said, thou should have smitten five or six times. Then hast thou smitten Syria till thou hast consumed it, whereas now thou shalt but smite Syria but thrice. So what does that tell me? In modern day parlance, that means he had a 7-round clip. I mean, he had 7 arrows in his quiver. Okay, so the first one was shot, you know, at the instruction of the prophet. But it seems like he had 5 or 6 rounds left, and he should have done all of them. Why did he do 3? Good question. I don't know. Some commentators have speculated that 3, the Jews were required to appear before the Lord 3 times a year for the major feasts. So maybe they considered 3 to be a complete number, a complete cycle. Who's shooting the arrows here? Was this a godly king that was familiar with the Old Testament law? No. Now, it's very possible that, I mean, I'm going to make a statement here that even if you're not a sports person, you're probably familiar with. 3 strikes and you're out. I mean, it's very possible that that was kind of a proverbial saying, you know, or a kind of an idea that everybody understood, all right? 3 is enough. 3 strikes, you're out. I don't know. But Elisha tells him, you should have emptied the clip, if I'm going to use modern day parlance. You should have shot all the arrows. He said, for each one that you shot, that will be a particular deliverance, but 3 battles won is not going to be enough to get Syria completely off your back. If you had emptied your quiver and shot all of them, that would have been enough to, you know, permanently get rid of the king of Syria. What is the application for you and me there? I think it's simply this. He did what he thought was good enough, but not absolutely everything he possibly could have done. You know, maybe we should take from that, okay, when I'm serving the Lord or praying to the Lord or, you know, working for the Lord, I need to be concerned with doing the very best, not, you know, well, that's good enough or that's probably enough. But at this point in time, we, based on the timelines, as best we can tell, Jehoash became king approximately 60 years after the death of Ahab. Okay? Now, if you remember the confrontation with Elijah and Ahab on Mount Carmel, Elijah puts water on the sacrifice, prays down fire from heaven, and then Jezebel says, I'm going to kill you, boy, and he runs away. When he runs away and God finally, you know, speaks to him in the still small voice, he gave him 3 tasks. What was one of those tasks? The one of those tasks was related to Elisha, did it not? He said, go anoint Elisha to take your spot and train him. So then he went and found Elisha and threw his mantle on him, which symbolically said, God's called you to take my spot. And Elisha followed Elijah at that point. So Elisha was an adult man at that point, best we can tell. So I'm going to go with 20 years old because that's what we understand from Jewish culture. But if he's 20 years old at that point, and then you see he overlapped with Elijah for a while, and he still overlapped with Ahab some as well. And then it's another 60 years from that point to here when we get the story of his death. 20 plus 60 plus however, you know, it's very possible that Elijah's in his late 80s or 90s at this point. Okay, which is a very long lifespan, okay, the blessing of God. But this is the, you know, the last recorded act of Elisha. Verse 20, though, tells us there was one more miracle after his death. Verse 20, Elisha died, they buried him, and the bands of the Moabites invaded the land at the coming in of the year. What does that phrase mean, at the coming in of the year? Not a trick question. What do you think that means? Yeah, at the start of the next year, here comes Syria again. Okay, if you remember, in the story of David and Bathsheba, there's a statement in there that says, at the time when kings go forth to battle. So there was a time of year that was not as conducive likely in the wintertime. And there was a time of year when the weather was a little more conducive, and if they show up somewhere, hopefully there's grass for the animals to graze on and stuff like that. So the next year, when the year came in at the beginning of the year, here comes Syria again. It came to pass, as they were burying a man, behold, they spied a band of men, and they cast the man into the sepulcher of Elisha. So it seems like there was a funeral in process, and they saw a band of soldiers from Syria, and they're like, uh-oh. So they quickly abandoned their digging process, and they, for convenience, tossed this man, or maybe they gently laid him in, I don't know, but they put the man in the tomb of Elisha the prophet. And when the man was let down and touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood up on his feet. That'll get your adrenaline flowing, won't it? Okay? I mean, that's like a staple of surprise gags, or, you know, even horror things or whatever. But I mean, this was their friend. They were digging a grave, and all of a sudden he stands back up. What we're not told is if any of his friends fainted. You know, it's a sepulcher, which, you know, it was likely a cave with a stone over the mouth or that kind of thing. Probably wasn't as high a ceiling as this room here. I mean, did they jump, you know, whack their head on the ceiling? I mean, what happened? We don't know the rest of the story. But this was the final recorded miracle of Elisha that, you know, God did after the death of Elisha. Verse 22, Hazael, king of Syria, oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoahaz. So because he did not, you know, go as far as he could have when he already had been told this is God's deliverance, and he did good enough instead of everything that he had, well then he got partial deliverance, but he had to deal with Syria as an oppressor his entire time. Okay? There's a couple of more things I would like to look at here, but we don't have enough time to wrap that up. So we will stop there for today, and Lord willing, wrap that up next time. Let's close with a word of prayer.